are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, December 2nd, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, host of the Vox Media podcast and author of For the Love of Man, A Vision for Mindful Masculinity, Liz Plank will join us on the program. Meanwhile, round two of impeachment begins in the House Judiciary on Wednesday as Donald Trump, unwilling to risk offering a defense. Also on the program today, hundreds of Trump campaign ads taken down by Google and Facebook for violating their terms of service. What terms those were, we do not know. The Iraqi prime minister resigns amid protests and government killing hundreds. Meanwhile, in neighboring and arguably controlling Iran, also racked by mass protests, the greatest in 40 years, with their government killing hundreds as well. 18 days and counting to pass a government spending bill. Meanwhile, Nancy Pelosi wants Democrats to pass the new NAFTA, but ignores a bill that would strengthen unions and could easily pass the House. UN head warns of a point of no return on climate as COP25 begins in Madrid. And Steve Bullock and Joe Sestak have dropped out of the Democratic primary race. Also, they were in the Democratic primary race. Yesterday marks the 64th anniversary of Rosa Parks protesting. And lastly, socialism comes to Florida. This time, disguised as a supermarket. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. I hope you had a good Thanksgiving. We are all back here, except for half of the crew. I want to say that we have a skeleton crew, but really, in many respects, we have the muscle, too. We got the muscle and the skeleton.
Brandon, the heart, Brendan's, all your vital organs.
Brendan's here. Matt's here. Michael is somewhere else. Jamie is on a health situation. Nothing's wrong. I'm just saying it's going around, folks. It's going around. Let me just mention a couple of quick things up top and tell you, first off, we don't know what we're going to do on Wednesday. The impeachment hearings will be in the Judiciary Committee. They will be, as far as I know, exclusively talking about the law, really the Constitution in this instance. There's not going to be any facts presented. We're going to hear a report from the Intelligence Committee, which I think people hopefully should have a sense of what it would be at this point. And there's going to be constitutional experts who are going to speak to whether Donald Trump blackmailing, extorting, attempting to blackmail the president of Ukraine to help him in the 2020 election, whether that crosses the threshold of an impeachable offense, not to mention obstruction. There are many other offenses, it seems to me, and there are other committees supposedly working on this. I don't know that they're going to maintain their work. I just don't know. Nobody really knows. Sure seems to me like they should. Part of it is because you get Republicans going on Fox News Live trying to come up with just the most ridiculous. Look, if by this point in the impeachment process, the members of the House Judiciary Committee who are Republicans can't get their metaphors straight, even their dumb talking points straight, then you know this is a problem for them. Now, we also just saw a poll, and I'll probably refer to this multiple times, probably for the rest of my life. 52% of Republicans think that Donald Trump is a better president than Abraham Lincoln was. Which I know is very hard to articulate without laughing. But so there's nobody watching this on Fox News who needs to be convinced of anything, right? It's just a little bit shore up, give them a talking point. But if you can't even articulate the talking point, then I think that that's indicative of the pressure, at least, is they're feeling it in the Republicans. I don't know that it's going to have any material difference other than they can't go on the offensive because they're stumbling through the defense. Here is Ben Klein on Fox News Live. And Bill Hemmer, you know, would have to be three sheets to the wind, as we say, to buy this one.
Final question, Congressman, as far as, and I heard you mention your colleague Jerry Nadler on multiple occasions here, that will be a big difference in the look and feel of this hearing happening on Wednesday compared to the 31 hours we saw before the Intel Committee. Chairman Jerry Nadler has a very different style of Adam Schiff, chairman of the Intel Committee. What do you expect from him and how he will lead this hearing on Wednesday?
Well, you know, with the Mueller report, look at it this way. We had Star Wars. The Empire got destroyed, just like the Mueller report got destroyed. The sequel is here. It's the Empire Strikes Back, or as we like to say, the Intelligence Committee strikes back. Adam Schiff strikes back. But we all know how the story ends. The rebels win. Ultimately, the president will be exonerated, and we don't anticipate.
All right, wait, we need to go back because this is actually worse than I thought it was. So he says Star Wars, right? The first one, the Empire gets destroyed. Now, of course, the Empire doesn't get destroyed in the first Star Wars. The Death Star does. And then he says the Empire strikes. The Mueller report was the Empire getting destroyed. Then the Intelligence Committee is the Empire. And they strike back. But let's just go back again.
Had Star Wars. The Empire got destroyed, just like the Mueller report got destroyed. The sequel is here. It's the Empire Strikes Back, or as we like to say, the Intelligence Committee strikes back. Adam Schiff strikes back. But we all know how the story ends. The rebels win. Ultimately, the president will be exonerated, and we don't anticipate there being any reason to go forward with these hearings.
Yeah, there we go.
I don't know much about Star Wars. I've only seen the first one, but I do know that Chewbacca is Gorka.
And there was more than three. There was a lot of Star Wars. But the Empire Strike Back, the rebel, that's the president's, or there is the rebellion. See, there you go. Like I say, I think that's indicative of some problems they may be having. Folks, I've told you this before, hiring's a challenge. There's one place you can go to hire where hiring is simple, it's fast, it's smart, it's ZipRecruiter. In fact, the 50% of the employees who show up around here were hired from ZipRecruiter. But Codeable, a company co-founded by Gretchen Huebner, experienced how challenging hiring can be after unsuccessfully searching for a new game artist to grow with her education tech company. But then she switched to ZipRecruiter and saw an immediate difference. And you can, too, by signing up for free at ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. And by using ZipRecruiter's screening questions to filter candidates, Gretchen found it easier to focus on the best ones than find the right one. In fact, after posting her job on ZipRecruiter, Gretchen said she was honestly surprised she found qualified applicants so quickly and hired a new game artist in less than 2 weeks. With results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Folks, I'm one of those 4. I mean, I assume there's more than 4 of us, but I got a ton of great applicants. Brendan was just super awesome. And ZipRecruiter found you, right? Didn't you tell me that?
Yeah.
He walked in here. The best part was, I told the story many times. I said, look, what we do is we clip for YouTube. I know. At my last job, I had to block you guys because I was looking for the raw footage and you guys were covering all the clips I was looking for.
It was awful.
And that's how I knew. ZipRecruiter, it's the smartest way to hire. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at our web address, ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. I've told you folks this many times. The best time to look for new hires is when you don't need anybody, so you're not under the pressure. Speaking of time, if you feel like you can't find the time to read all the books on your list, well, welcome to my club. It's called Sam's List of Books That He Doesn't Have Time to Read Club. But Blinkist is an app that compiles the key takeaways from thousands of nonfiction books. Everything you need to know is condensed down to 15 minutes that you can read or, my favorite, listen to. Blinkist is really unique. It works on your phone, your tablet, your web browser. You'll find everything from health to self-help titles to history to business books, including Blinkist's library. I've told you many of the books that I've read. I'll be honest with you. It's the personal development ones. I'm not going to sit down. I'm not going to read The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, but I will invest 15 minutes in it. And I bet you one of the 7 habits, doing something like Blinkist.
Let's get summaries.
Yep. Getting things done. How to make people like you in 90 seconds or less. I need that big time. I actually need one that says like what you do right after that and for the next several years. But the amazing thing about this is they're books that you look at and you're like, you know what? If I could read that in 15 minutes, I'd do it. Well, now's your chance. But they don't just have personal development. They have entrepreneurship, politics, marketing, sales, health, nutrition, history, communication skills, psychology, motivation, inspiration, parenting. Jeez. I didn't realize they had parenting. I should have gotten on that. With Blinkist, you get unlimited access to read or listen to a massive library of condensed nonfiction books. All the books you want for one low price. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer for our listeners. Go to Blinkist.com/majority. Try it for free for 7 days and save 25% off your new subscription. That's Blinkist, Blinkist.com/majority to start your free 7-day trial and save 25% off. Do it now, folks, particularly if you have children. Get to that parenting section. And meanwhile, speaking of how ill everybody I know is, are you trying to drink more water? You should. Keeps you healthy. Liquid IV hydrates you 2 to 3 times faster and more efficiently than water alone, with the added bonus of vitamin C, B3, B5, B6, and B12. It's times like these, I think people can hear it in my voice a little bit. I think I might be headed for under the water. I will pound this stuff. I will also do it, you know, the holidays, maybe I overindulge a little bit in the liquor, portion of things. This also helps with that, both in the morning and the night of. When I travel, for people who are just underhydrated, Liquid IV is the fastest growing wellness brand. All of their products are non-GMO, vegan, they're free of gluten, dairy, and soy. You can find Liquid IV everywhere, even Costco. It's a great healthy alternative to traditional sugary sports drinks. It's perfect for fueling tough workouts, preventing muscle fatigue, promoting healthy post-workout recovery. Plus, it's in convenient TSA-friendly powder packets for travel. I love Liquid IV. this whole office does. I know you guys will too. Right now, my listeners get 25% off of liquidiv.com when you use my code MAJORITY at checkout. That's 25% off anything you order on Liquid IV's website. Go to liquidiv.com, enter my promo code MAJORITY, get your savings, and start getting better hydration. That's liquidiv.com, promo code MAJORITY. Don't wait. Start properly hydrating today. Folks, we'll put links to all of that in our podcast and YouTube subscriptions. Just two things I want to point out. Well, I guess one, and then maybe I'll talk about the other ones. But yesterday marked the 64th anniversary of Rosa Parks, when she started essentially the Montgomery bus boycott. What people don't realize about Rosa Parks was she was the, I think it was the Montgomery secretary of the NAACP. And this was not a spontaneous protest. This was planned. And it just shows the relevance of activism and what it can spark and the sort of like what it can show. And important to note, if you want, go back to April 15th, 2011. I was at the tort conference I go to, and a lot of those lawyers are also civil rights lawyers. And I interviewed, I think his name was Fred Gray, and he was Rosa Parks' attorney at that time. So check that out. Interesting story. He was a little bit cagey about it. It's almost like they didn't want they didn't want to reveal that it was actually a full on protest. All right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, and I will get to this story about this Florida town that has started some type of socialism. It's fascinating. It really is. We got to be very, very quiet about it. Just a reminder, this program relies on your support. If you have the finances and you want to support the show, join themajoritypresents.com. Join themajoritypresents.com. It is your support that makes the show possible. When you do join themajoritypresents.com, we give you extra content just about every single day. We also give you the free show, commercial free. And I guess that's about it, but there's a feel-good quality to this too. I think that you cannot underestimate. Incidentally, we are now streaming on multiple platforms. Brendan and Matt have figured this out. And so tell your friends.
It's not going to stop there either.
Yeah, we're at Twitch and YouTube today. Maybe Facebook in the future.
Oh, we never got to Facebook. What about Twitter? Never got that?
Nope.
Oh, all right. Well,
it's a rollout process.
ZipRecruiter.com. All right. We'll see you in a minute.
Lying next to you.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program a host at Vox Media, author of The Love of Men, A Vision for Mindful Masculinity. Liz Plank, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really thrilled. I'm such a big fan.
Well, Liz, I'm a fan of yours. And this is sort of, I mean, this is not not out of my, well, it's out of my wheelhouse a little bit, but it's not, I mean, I think, you know, we talk about the implications of this, and I think the implications of this dynamic are far-reaching. But let's just talk about, because you start off, and I didn't realize this, I've known you for some time. I didn't realize that you had gotten a master's in gender studies. Will you just talk? Will you talk about gender as a construct?
Yeah. So gender is similarly to race. It's a social construct, right? So of course there are differences between men and women, and you know, visible ones. There's hormonal differences. They're often associated with our sex. But gender is actually something that we do. It's something that we learn how to do very, very early on when we're, you know, handed a blue onesie or a pink onesie, depending on what gender we were assigned at birth. And those differences are really ingrained and really culturally significant. So if you meet someone and you don't know which gender they are, it actually will probably, you'll keep thinking about it the whole time. If you know, someone is pregnant, what's the first question that we sort of ask them, you know, is it a boy or is it a girl, right? We give a lot of importance to this without even realizing that we do, but these differences really define so much of our lives. And I just saw so many interesting conversations about how gender was, you know, impacting the lives of women, impacting the lives of girls, how we were brought up. And I didn't see as many conversations talking about how, you know, the same kind of doing gender, right? These differences and the way that we socialize boys and men also impact them. And so I wanted to offer a sort of, you know, make sure that we have the same kind of healthy, beautiful conversation and curiosity about how gender impacts the lives of men as much as we're curious about how it impacts the lives of women.
How much does he... Well, so I don't want to get ahead of myself here, because I have to say, it. I mean, the whole question is fascinating to me, because I have a daughter who was, until she was 7 or 8, an only child. And I have a son now who's, you know, obviously 6, 7 years, 7, 8 years younger than she is. Wow. And, it was interesting to see, like, you know, like so much is happening at school in terms of gender, in terms of constructing that. Like, my son was, you know, prior to school, before hanging out with other boys, frankly, who, you know, come from other families, was not uptight about the color pink. But now he's very concerned about it. Nothing can be pink. And there's a lot more sort of like, both my kids are pretty physical, but the boy stuff gets to be like their guns and this and that. I mean, I think their interests are different too, but I can see that. And I found it fascinating, but I wonder, like, how much of what we're talking, you know, like the fact that women have had more, have paid more attention to gender is a function of, you know, not in an eternity, but obviously being their lives being far more implicated by the fact that they're not the, you know, the male gender. Do you know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like how much like of their destiny is a subject to their gender as opposed to any other factors?
Yeah, I think that we give so much attention to, well, even when we say the word gender equality, right? What comes to mind, you know, when I've even worked with, you know, governments or been a consultant for different companies, it's been, you know, female empowerment, right? Gender equals women. When we hear the words gender equality, we're thinking about how to help women release themselves from the ideals that society imposes on women because of their gender. But I actually would be really interested in us expanding our understanding of gender and how it operates in all of our lives, right? That gender equality programs, for example, should not just be focusing on girls and how we raise girls, but also how we raise boys. And that in many instances, when we actually ignore the fact that boys need support too, and that they need modeling too, and that they need to be given the tools to critically engage with a lot of those ideas that you just mentioned, right? That you can't wear anything pink, that if you're not good at sports or you're not interested in sports, that there's something wrong with you. Right. There are all these messages that are sent to boys from a very early age that model them into certain behaviors or if they can't, you know, or if they're not interested in those behaviors or those attitudes, they can bring a lot of shame. So there are a lot of men who are carrying a lot of shame from all of this, the socialization that they've been, you know, privy to. And there's not a lot of space for us as a society to critically reflect on those ideas, right? To think about the fact that, I mean, I write in the book that for many men in America, it's easier to get a gun than to find a therapist. In 2/3 of counties in the United States, there is no psychiatrist. There's no access to a psychiatrist. They have to go to another county. So men are far less likely to seek therapy. Therapy, in many ways, is an environment in which maybe women are more comfortable in because we have, made space for their emotions. We almost think that they have too many emotions. We expect them to be emotional, right? But we don't expect men to have the same kind of human emotions as women do. And when you're talking about guns too, and you know, it's really shocked me in many of the interviews that I had with, not just parents, but with people in general, what kind of toys were taken away from boys. So I talked to adult men and I said, what was a toy that you were, that you desperately wanted, but weren't allowed to have? And the amount of heartbreaking responses that I received just with that question, really showed me that there was something here. There was a lot of trauma there. It was everything from obviously Easy Bake Ovens, because God forbid men would, you know, want to cook or be interested in developing the skills to cook, but also, you know, dolls and, you know, teddy bears that were like, there was like a puppy cupcake that kept coming up. I don't know if that was like famous in the 80s or 90s with men today, but there were a puppy cupcake. It was like a puppy that I guess could go inside a cupcake. I tried to Google it, but I couldn't find much, but the how vivid those memories were, Sam, like the men remembered their parents whispering about it or being in fights about the toys that the boy wanted and that there was something wrong with him, right? That we couldn't give you this toy, or you can play with it, but no one can see you. You have to play with it alone. And so it's pretty remarkable that as a society, we're more comfortable seeing a boy play with a toy gun than play with a doll, right? That we're more comfortable seeing boys play with something that kills than play with something that cries. And again, for some boys, toy guns might be fine. And for some parents, it's, what they want to do. And I'm not telling parents what they should or should not do. But I think that we need to question these ideas that we have in our society about what is acceptable for men, how boys act and behave, and just question how much of it is true, first of all, right, that boys are more violent or that boys don't need as much intimacy or boys don't have as many emotions. Those things are just not true. There's one human species. We all have a deep desire to connect and to be intimate and to belong. And there are differences. Every child is different. But when we come in with those assumptions about boys, and whether it's at school, whether it's in the home, whether it's to your point with other kids and their parents and, you know, film and TV, right? We can't shelter our kids from all of those things. But we need to think about what is the message that we're sending? What are we telling boys that they need to be? And how are they then going to cope in a world where they can't reach those ideals or they're not interested in those ideals? And then what kind of big social problems can come from that?
All right. Well, so listen. I want to get to the question about, like, you know, specifically when we talk about gender equality, because I think that's true. I think the first thing that comes into people's minds is sort of like, but it also involves things like political power, economic power. Yeah. I mean, that's where the equality, in some level, it seems to come from on some level, or, as well as a social equality. But before we get to that, I just want to go back a little bit in the term toxic masculinity, which is one that I know you're not terribly excited about, but what does that mean? Like, in what areas are we talking about, right? If we divide things, and maybe we shouldn't, but for the sake of ease right here, I mean, there's a huge interplay, but we talk about sort of the social realm, if you will, the economic realm, and the political realm. And I think these are all, you know, they're actually far more connected, but I do think that just looking at them for a moment discreetly, as a way of analysis, but when we talk about this toxic masculinity, does it impact all three of those areas from your perspective? And to the extent that it does, what does it mean?
I mean, I'd be curious to hear what you think about that. You know, I obviously didn't grow up as a boy in our society, so, you know, the obviously this book is deeply reported, and I spent 4 years interviewing and talking to men and doing a lot of data and research. But I do think that there's a level of inequality, or again, there's an experience of difficulty, I think, growing up as a boy or a man in our society in all three of those realms. Just the economic one, I think, is really interesting, because to your point, I think it's hard to see how men, you know, how it's hard to be a man in our society when men have, you know, in every country all over the world, most of the economic power. And yes, men still make far more than women. There's still a very worrying gender gap all over the world. Women still do far more work inside the home. And there are men tend to overestimate how much domestic work that they do in their own families. So there's a lot of changes that we need to make in that realm. And women do suffer economically far more than men. At the same time, there are also a lot of economic pressures on men. One of the things that, I mean, there's an entire chapter about work, for example, in the book, where I start out with a quote from Chris Rock that says, if you lose your job, you lose your woman. And I think that there's something really powerful about what it means to be a man in our society. Every man that I talk to, whether they were, you know, Gen Xers, whether they were older, whether they were millennials, every man I talk to, when I said, what does it mean to be a man, talked about being a provider,
right,
talked about having a job, right? Talked about having a way to basically contribute to the people that they love financially. And it was very much tied, which is a very obviously capitalistic way of seeing what a provider is, right? If we had, I think, a looser understanding of gender, first of all, we would see women as equally providing as men are, even if they are working inside the home, right? So the person who buys the frozen chicken is just as important as the person who is able to make that chicken into a meal and serve it. So they're equally important roles, but somehow, because of, you know, the capitalism in our society and the individualistic nature of the way that we organize our families and organize ourselves, we make a hierarchy of which role is more important. But I wanted to ask
you about that, because I do think that, I mean, that I wonder how much, you know, when we look at, I think you talked about Iceland male roles there, and men in Iceland are particularly, you know, less subject, I guess, to sort of the general ills that men in other places are. And they've, you know, I'm not an expert in Icelandic economy, but they have a very, very generous social welfare state. And I wonder how much capitalism, particularly in the context of the United States, I mean, you know, I think all places, not all places, many European countries are mixed economies, and the balance of that between capitalism and socialism is at least relative to the United States, more socialistic. Yeah. I wonder how much that plays in to the at least in the context of how economic pressures play into sort of these social pressures, and how much you contemplate things would be like. Does it need to start with the state in many respects taking a lot of things off of people's plates so that there's not as much pressure to be a provider?
Right. Well, I love this question because it is not necessarily up to the state, but the state sets norms, right? Our policies are, of course, affecting our lives from a very from a policy perspective, and the financial ramifications of those things. But the way that we make policy in a country really sets the culture too. So if you look at a place like Iceland, for example, or obviously Denmark or any Scandinavian country, they have put a very important they place a very important role in terms of parental leave being genderless, right? So there's all kinds of different policies that they've put into place to make sure that men actually do take parental leave, right? So in Denmark, for example, they made the daddy leave. If the men don't take it, they lose it. They can't trade it and give it to the mother. So basically, they're giving up free, paid vacation, basically. I mean, it's not a vacation, but paid time off. And so men started taking it far more. And you look at a place like the United States, and I was just baffled when I was covering the 2016 campaign, and Donald Trump announced a parental leave policy, and it was, everyone was saying how progressive it was, and it was a big deal because he's a Republican, and Ivanka, his daughter, obviously was super involved in the creation of that policy. And then I was pretty excited to see what it was going to be like, and when they announced it, it actually did not include fathers. It was 2016, and a parental leave policy, and the parental leave policy was only for moms. So the assumption there, again, he wasn't in government yet, obviously, but the assumption there coming from that policy is the cultural idea that parenting is up to the mother, and that fathers cannot be fully responsible or equally responsible for the children that they have with those mothers. And obviously that, gay fathers don't exist. I don't know, right? Like, what are gay fathers supposed to do? Because none of them are going to be a woman. And so they won't have access to any parental leave. And so it has impacts on our culture. And what you find is that men, and a big point in the book that I'm trying to make, and that is supported by a lot of data, is that men fare better in feminist countries. Men fare better in countries where there are laws that make women's lives better. They also end up making men's lives better. And that was one of the reasons why I went to Iceland. I literally went to Iceland to save men from feminism, because I had learned from people like Donald Trump and Tucker Carlson that feminism was very bad for men. And so I went to Iceland, and I literally walked around with a sign that says, like, blink twice, like, if you want me to bring you to the United States, like, I will save you. And none of the Icelandic men wanted to go to America, because most of them were pretty happy living in this feminist utopia, right? So Iceland, for those of you who might not know, has just been, I mean, for now 10 years in a row, has been from the World Economic Forum, creates this index every year of a gender equality index, and Iceland has been number one for the last decade in terms of the best place to be a woman on earth.
Well, what constitutes that? I mean, because I guess my point is that it seems to me that the question of divvying up who gets these benefits is downstream, right, from the idea of these benefits existing.
Yeah.
And if the benefits exist and are universal, right, and no man, no woman has to worry about, let's say, health insurance. Like, we don't have to pay for that health insurance. Obviously, we all pay taxes and whatnot.
Right.
But but that's not a, you know, an enormous expense. I mean, to the extent that men feel pressure being breadwinners, or that anybody feels, you know, intense pressure being breadwinners, it seems to me that it would be bad for women and bad for men. The idea that we just exclusively reserve that for men, because that's what we've been doing, is bad. But it's sort of bad that we need to have anybody sort of feel that it's a life or death situation for their significant other or their kids or however that works.
Yeah, absolutely. And what you find is actually in feminism can act as a buffer for male suicide. That has been true consistently, not just in the United States, but in not just in one, you know, moment in time, but throughout numerous recessions, whether it was in Europe or the United States or even in Hong Kong in the 90s, there's data showing that, first of all, across the board, when there are economic downturns, which I think we are starting to be in one right now, or it hopefully will not get worse, but when there's an economic recession, basically, all suicide kind of goes up, but women's suicide barely goes up. Male suicide can skyrocket, right? So when your entire purpose in life and the purpose of your identity, what makes you a man? Providing. When that is taken away from you, or something that, again, an ideal that you cannot reach, you know, you lose your job and there are no other jobs available, male suicide just goes way up. And we're actually seeing this right now. Male suicide and suicide in general is very high in the United States, but it's far, you know, suicide, deaths by suicide is the vast majority of gun deaths in America. And 80% of those gun deaths by suicide are happening to men. Mm-hmm. And so you see, when there are these economic downturns in societies where women are playing a very important economic role, where they're economic equals, where they are involved in, you know, they have jobs, they're, you know, providing, quote unquote, just as much as men are. In those societies, there is less of that big gap between male and female suicide. So yes, there are more suicides and it is difficult during times of recession, but the male suicide rate does not skyrocket as much in societies that are, if you want, more feminist. And so there's an interest for governments and for states to have more feminist policies. Obviously, having more feminist policies make the world a better place for women, right? We don't have, to your point, healthcare policies that either make it, you know, more difficult to have children or more difficult for people to literally live, but also that aren't unequal for women, right? We had for the longest time, I mean, moving from Canada to the United States when we were in the midst of the Obamacare debate was so fascinating to me, because I just couldn't believe that you could, that there was a policy where you paid more money because you were a woman, and that there were people who were defending the idea that just because women give birth and women, you know, have uteruses, basically we should be charged more money. That's just so wild of an idea. And so to have our government officials literally defending that sexism was just so wild to me. And so, yes, it totally trickles down. And if we live in a society where we have different policies, it does change the culture. But what we're seeing right now is obviously a culture war at the level of our policymakers.
Right.
And we're seeing it with abortion, we're seeing it with healthcare, we're seeing it with everything. And I think what the Democrats need to do, and, you know, to make this a political conversation and pivot right into that, because I have trouble not to, but it's, you know, Democrats have to defend, you know, the rights of women, but I think that they have to do a better job of showing how those policies that are better for women are also better for men. That the Republicans are making men's lives shorter, they're making them less satisfying, and they're making it more, you know, right now under Trump, as, you know, we've heard from authors like Jonathan Metzl, you know, who wrote Dying of Whiteness, the life expectancy of men, and particularly white men, has actually gone down under Trump. And so, yes, the lives of women are far worse under a Republican administration, but so are the lives of men.
To what extent, I also have this sort of theory that there is a that as women gain more power, relevance, you know, political, economic power,
yeah,
in society, men will necessarily lose it. And specifically, yeah, I think this is the case, you know, white men will, yeah, lose it. And as we see, women and, you know, black men and Latino men and mm-hmm, black women, Latino women, as they gain more power, white men will lose it. They are, yeah, less centered in our society. It's a sort of a joke around here, but it is to some degree a zero sum situation, right?
Right.
Like, what are we offering? You know, and I don't know that the society has a responsibility to offer, you know, a soft landing, but if right, we wanted to make the landing, softer or easier, is there really an offer? I mean, what can you do?
See, like, and this is, I'm just a glass half full kind of person, and I've had a lot of discussions about like this. I personally believe that it's not a zero-sum game. I think that human rights are not a zero-sum game. White people, for example, during the civil rights era, did not lose from being in a world that was more equal, where black people didn't have to, you know, literally go to the bathroom in a different place. I think that we do really all gain from equality, and someone else being less free makes me less free too. And that's the part, even, you know, Sam, I get so many women who are angry about my book and about the discourse that I've chosen when it comes to gender equality, because they see me as again, because I'm talking about the importance of supporting boys and supporting men, that somehow I'm taking away from the support that we have for women and girls. And that's where I think it comes back to it's such an individualistic perception to think that someone else having a better life, your neighbor being happier, your neighbor being healthier, your neighbor being able to fully express themselves and reach their potential, their human potential in our society, absolutely makes my life better, because he's my neighbor and we're living in the same society, right? It's like the idea that people wanted Trump to, you know, totally fail when he's the one piloting the plane. You don't want someone on your plane to be sick. You want someone on your plane to be, you know, unhappy and to be screaming the whole time. We're all in the same plane. We're all in the same world, and we're all connected. And so I think that we have to have a different framing when we're talking about equality and gender equality, particularly because, and that's what I'm trying to do with this book. I'm trying to show, you know, for so long I was in the academic world, and I have a master's in gender. I was a women's studies major, and I never was assigned a book about masculinity. We always talked, right, about gender from the woman's perspective. And of course that perspective is so important, but I felt like it was a failure of the academic program that I, you know, had the privilege to take, but that I also worked really hard to do, that gender wasn't taught in not the zero sum game sort of mentality, that we all win when everyone is freer.
But,
and that's what I hope we can do more of. And again, that's what I think the Democrats need to do, because when we only talk about how ending racism helps people of color, absolutely it does. It also is better for white people. Living in a racist society has negative outcomes for everyone. And so we have to, as progressives, do a better job of talking about these fights for social justice as really benefiting everybody. And that's what I, you know, and we can argue about this all day. I think.
Well, let me just argue about it for just a little bit more because I mean, I have been accused of being a half glass, half empty type of person in general, but here's my point though, is that, like, just, and I use this as an example just because it's simple. It's not so much a question that I, as a white man, have an issue with someone else, mm-hmm, becoming more free or more economically powerful.
Yeah.
But look, when I grew up in the early 70s, and gained a consciousness. Whenever I turned on my TV, I would see myself reflected back at me. If it wasn't exactly me, it was my mom who was making a pitch to other moms to help me. Or it was a wife making a pitch to help someone like my dad. Like I was centered. And that is not the case anymore. That's just simply not the case because, you know, everybody's included in these ads now. And everybody's looking on the TV shows. I mean, and that is a real change. It is a real loss. It's I don't think it's the most important one necessarily. But from a cultural thing, I went from being told, like, you are the most important person.
Right.
And now I'm not. And so I guess the question is like, can we just try and sort of like reorient without there being some material benefit to, you know, maybe everybody can share in it because I will still get it. But like, it's not enough just to say to me, like, you don't have to be the provider. Unless, like, somebody else is stepping in, and it's not necessarily, I mean, going to be necessarily another individual. If there's another entity stepping in and providing some stuff to take that pressure off me.
Right. Yeah. So I think that you're absolutely right. And I think what we're seeing right now, and I'm hearing, I'm sure you hear this a lot, too, probably even more because maybe men feel safer saying it to you than to me. But I think that there are a lot of particularly white men who feel like the world is against them. And I'm hearing this not just from, you know, men who are, you know, adults. And I'm hearing this from moms who have 8 or 9 year old sons who are white boys. And feel like that there's something inherently wrong with them, and that they like that kind of like the world is stacked against them, which seems wild coming from you know, a middle class white boy to feel. But I think that we are now in a moment of, I wouldn't call it overcompensation, but we're compensating. We're compensating for decades and, you know, centuries of deep-seated gender inequality and deep-seated racism and homophobia and transphobia and ableism, right? So, yeah, when you open, I don't know, your Netflix page or whatever, that home screen, 10 years ago even, not even that long ago, it was mostly stories about white men and, you know, they had women were supporting characters, people of color were the one friend, and, you know, trans people were virtually inexistent. And even, you know, the percentage of characters on TV that are disabled is so low, and very often they're played by, you know, able-bodied people, which is so offensive. And we're starting to see more stories centering around those, you know, disabled actors, disabled characters. And I think that those, you know, I think we both agree that those, all those things are good things. But I think that when we, it sucks that we have to do that though,
right?
It sucks that we have to, you know, and we've all heard this, that when we're hiring, for example, we don't want to hire a white guy anymore, right? And I know I'm not supposed to say that, but that's in a lot of different, especially creative fields, we're you know, directors, for example, we're seeing white men who are super talented and super skilled. It's harder to find a gig right now because there has been such a huge inequality when it comes to directing, right? 3% of directors were women, and we're just starting to want to correct that. And so there's so much, you know, compensation for that. The pendulum was so far to one point that we have to send it to the other end. And that does mean that for some white men, it might be harder for them to find a job right now. And that sucks. I mean, I don't think that we should have to take anyone's opportunity away based on their gender or their race ever. But because we've been doing it from one side, now we're doing it so hard on the other side. And yeah, I do think that for some white boys, it kind of sucks. They're seeing the future as female. They're seeing, you know, jokes about white men all the time, that white men are trash, that men are trash. imagine coming into the world and having done, you know, you have no choice over what gender you have. You have no choice over what race you have. And this is the message that you're getting. And I think, again, that's what I'm trying to make that message more digestible, and I'm trying to make that message more accessible too, so that everyone can see how, yeah, having different kinds of people on your TV screen and not only seeing stories about white men, sure, it can mean that all of a sudden I'm losing something, or all of a sudden everything was about me and now, you know, some things are about me. But ultimately that makes a better world for everyone. And it means that we won't have to overcompensate in the future, that no one will have entitlement about how, focused the world should be on them and how central they should be to every narrative. I think that entitlement, we have to really question, you know, obviously entitlement, in male entitlement or white entitlement, right? Any kind of entitlement is viewed as a very, I don't know, it's like a political term. But I think on a spiritual level, having entitlement is probably the most corrosive, you know, feeling that you can have about your life. Feeling entitled to being comfortable, feeling entitled to being happy, feeling entitled to other people's time or care or attention. It's, you're setting yourself up to be unhappy because that void will never be filled. And so I think if we can build a society where everyone's a little less entitled to being at the center of everything, whether they're white or black or female or male or gender non-binary, I think that just makes better humans.
Liz Plank, the book is For the Love of Men, A New Vision for
Mindfulness. I haven't convinced you, haven't I?
Well, I mean, look, I agree. I agree. Me personally, am I convinced? Sure. But I do think that there is I run into those guys that you're talking about who sort of bemoan like nothing's fair for them, but it is. I mean, particularly the guys that I run into for the most part. I think to a certain extent, though, for folks who are you mix in this loss of being centered with economic deprivation. And, you know, this sort of slow economic deprivation, I sort of feel like unless society puts something on the table and says, here's how your life is going to materially benefit from you being unshackled, and the sequencing is different. Like, this is going to make it easier for you to sort of unshackle yourself from that sense that you have to be the provider because... Yeah. You're provided, not totally, but it's easier to do that. There's more latitude.
Yeah.
I think society needs to provide that stuff. Like you say, it's not just a question of society making the distinction between moms only get parental leave and not dads, but rather the concept of parental leave, the idea that like we're aware of what parents go through. So we're going to make it easier on you as parents. But we should also extend that to like, we're aware of what you go through when you're only making X dollars an hour or when you're working at a job that is more physically difficult than others. And we're going to take certain things off the table. So they're just not weighing on you at 3 a.m.
And people, you know, and seeing suffering, right? Like, I think that, again, when we have this conversation, and we're just, you know, male privilege, I think it's not the best term for a lot of men, particularly who don't feel privileged and are, you know, struggling to make ends meet, and they are suffering in this economy as well. And I think that ultimately, yes, people want to be offered something. They also want to be understood and they want to be seen. And ultimately, I think that this is what this conversation needs to be about. It needs to be about, you know, that seeing women suffering does not mean that we're not seeing men's. And we're not going to rank those sufferings. We're going to see how they're connected and how the same system that creates female suffering actually also creates men, and how liberating women from that system also liberates men. And so I think that we agree on the solution. I'm more optimistic that men will see what they gain from that once it's presented to them, or you know, that the message has been, I think, sent in the right way, which I'm not sure it always is right now.
For the Love of Men, A New Vision for Mindful Masculinity. Liz Plank, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam. It's so fun talking to you.
It was great talking to you, too. All right, thanks. Folks, going to head into the fun half of the program, wherein we will have even more fun than we already had. That was pretty fun. It's a fascinating topic, and I do think that we are in an era, and I think this, you know, where for culture to change, it's painful. It's painful, and it's going to be, I don't know how you measure pain in this way, but loss of privilege stinks. But also having some segments of the population that are more privileged than other also stinks. And at one point, the Band-Aid has to come off. And we don't necessarily get to choose when that Band-Aid comes off. History sort of dictates it. Or, you know, future after it gets here. And then it's history.
Or Hillary Clinton will dictate it. Feminazis coming for us.
Exactly. Right, of course. That's exactly my point. But I do think that... The evidence is there that material benefits assuage that. And if you're going to try and create equality from a gender perspective, it's a very tough needle to thread unless you start to add more equality across other planes of existence in society. Right?
So it's basically as simple as lowering the stakes for all of this, right?
Well, that's the whole thing behind her talking about the provider thing and the downturn in the economy being correlated with the rise in suicides.
Exactly. If there wasn't more pressure in that situation, if society was built that despite downturns in economics, that the stakes for people is not literally life and death, then there would be less people taking their lives. I think the part of that conversation about, part of it is also how you raise your kids. But at the end of the day, you can tell your kids, it's not going to be on you to take care of everybody. But then at one point, it's wait a second. Who's going to step up and do this? The pressure doesn't go away. And maybe the point is just we're just not going to make it gender specific. You and the other person that you get, build a life with, or the other people's, I guess, you'll just fight it out as to who's going to have primary responsibility. You're going to negotiate it out. But just understand that the stakes are going to be super, super high. They're going to be super, super high. The metaphor is also, high stakes is high stakes. I have no problem my kids taking tests at school. But the problem is that when you make it high stake testing, when the future of the school itself or the future of the teacher depends on the score that the median student gets, then all of a sudden it has a corrupting influence on the agenda of everybody. And if you can see that, then you can see it in terms of society. The higher stakes the idea of losing a job or not having health insurance. When the stakes are that high, it just creates more pressure. And it makes letting go of these gender-defined roles, these constructed roles, harder. So, I don't know. I also think it's tough. I think it's tough for men to examine it, too, because, you know, particularly for my generation, I think it's probably changed a little bit with younger people, but and certainly before my generation, you don't grow up thinking of yourself as a gender. You grow up and think of yourself as just the norm. And then anybody else is different. You don't see difference as a sort of a dynamic. You just see it as like non-men guys, non-men, non-white men type of thing. And I think that frankly played into the idea of how people voted against Hillary Clinton. One of the reasons why they did of the and there's a myriad, I know, was, you know, like I've said in the past, there were people out there who were going like, I was okay with one non-normal president, but two non-normal presidents in a row? F that.
Well, the alt-right has popularized the concept of an NPC. You know what that is? It's called a non-player character, like in a video game where nobody can actually control. They're just there to like give you tasks or information. That's what they consider like non-fascists, basically. It's an NPCs. Look at all these NPCs defending Democrats, for instance.
Ah, interesting. All right, folks. Just a reminder, join themajorityreport.com. You can become a member of this program. Also, sign up for the AM Quickie. Liz is going to be listening to it now. She downloaded the wrong app to call into the show. So now she's got the Majority Report app.
I failed to record that conversation for promotional purposes.
Oh, that's too bad. MajorityApp.com to pick up the app. When you get the app, which is totally free, you can search the archives, you can stream the show, you can watch the show, you can watch it live, you can see it live, watch it live, same thing, hear it live. You can obviously listen to the podcast. You can also listen to the AM Quickie. Please do. Join themajorityreport.com. Don't forget to check out TMBS, patreon.com/TMBS. Also, The Antifada, patreon.com/The Antifada. And Matt, Literary Hangover, what do you have for us this week?
There was a brand new episode out on Saturday, The Crucible by Arthur Miller, the 1953 play that's sort of loose about the Salem witch trials and about McCarthyism. We talk about how the evil preacher Samuel Parris in The Crucible and in real life was a failed slave owner in Barbados. He wasn't able to turn his dad's $7,000 fortune and slave plantation into money, so he had to go become a preacher. And he was just very bad at business generally. And we also talk about how Arthur Miller was a fellow traveler who escaped the notice of HUAC, the House on American Activities Committee, until he started dating and announced a marriage to Marilyn Monroe. And then HUAC's like, oh, we can put some leverage on the studios with him now. And he gets called in to testify, and his testimony is similar to John Proctor's in The Crucible, actually. He refuses to give names of other people.
Interesting. Heady stuff. See you in the fun half. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
That's some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5. five times, 847-906-5014-572-38-56-27. One half, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance. My first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agreed.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.
Hey, folks, just a reminder: this episode has been brought to you by Blinkist. The Blinkist app takes the key takeaways from thousands of best-selling nonfiction books and condenses them down into just 15 minutes for you to read or listen to. 10 million people are using Blinkist right now. It has a massive and growing library from self-help and business to health and history books. Right now, you can get 25% off your first year of Blinkist by going to Blinkist.com/majority. Blinkist.com/majority.